It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one and live its creed.
So there's a good reason that these are the most oft-quoted lines from Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, even though it's oft-quoted with changing the men part to people, sometimes by people who prefer to hear it that way. But the reason it's quoted so often is because most people would like to be known and appreciated by others because of the content of our characters. I certainly would. Nobody wants to be seen or evaluated or judged or related to through the narrow lens of any of the many other characteristics that we may have, especially the characteristics that are maybe obviously more visible and that help create a first impression before anyone knows a thing about the content of your character. I certainly hope that when you first meet me, you will see more than an older white man. There is more to me than that. And I'm sure each of you feel the same way about the obvious identities that you carry that are part of the first impression that you make. Those identities that involve gender, skin color, body type, voice, accent, hairstyle, abilities or disabilities. These are all a part of who we are, and they are either biological givens or choices that we have made. So if this is true, if none of us want to be seen through a defining lens of any single characteristic that we have, is it wrong to be conscious of race? Is it wrong to pay attention to whatever skin color or distinguishing ethnic characteristics a person might have? In many ways, growing up Unitarian Universalist during the years of the Civil Rights Movement, I was taught that being race conscious was wrong. What was right was to oppose laws that discriminated against people according to their race. But beyond that, I was raised that we should be colorblind because, of course, everybody's the same underneath. What good you would argue with that? When this country elected its first African-American president in 2008, there was a feeling expressed in some of our media that we were entering a new era of colorblindness, a post-racial America. Ironically, the opposite has seemed to be true, as the ongoing, anguished American conversation about race and racism has only intensified. And long-standing taboo topics that most white people didn't want to talk about, such as whether police forces and justice systems are inherently racist, or whether all of our institutions are afflicted with embedded attitudes of white supremacy, are now being commonly discussed in all of our public and social media and forums. Last spring in Unitarian Universalism, we had a tsunami of self-examination about how white supremacy attitudes exist and function within our UUA's leadership and governance, and two-thirds of our congregations accepted the invitation and the challenge to conduct teach-in worship services and workshops about white supremacy. Here in Sterling, for various good reasons, we were not one of them. But I've also suspected some not so good reasons why we were not one of them. One of the not-so-good reasons might be a certain moral exhaustion with ongoing conversations about race and racism. Some of that may be tied to the belief that being colorblind is morally better than being race-conscious. And I am guessing that some of that moral exhaustion exists among members of our church who may identify as people of color and who are just tired of being involved in endless conversations with white people about their shame and guilt and worry and aspirations for a colorblind society. For white people in our congregation, I'm speaking personally, of course, the moral exhaustion comes from having to be race conscious more regularly than we are accustomed to. After all, what is the greatest of white privileges? It is to rarely have to think about your race as a factor that makes any difference in your life, other than to enhance it in ways that we frequently just take for granted. The routine fact that people of color have to be race conscious most days is exhausting in itself. And when white people get a taste of that, again, I speak personally, I feel like retreating back into my white bubble. I think the other not so good reason that we may have avoided the white supremacy teach-in last spring is the worry that conversations about racial and ethnic identity and the ways that racism works in our society must inevitably become politically partisan conversations. Now that is a bad reason, because even though there are plenty of public policy and legal issues where overt or hidden racism is a factor, and political parties do have different positions on some of those policy issues, we, believe me, have plenty to talk about and understand regarding racism beyond the conventional cable news discussions. None of the Republicans or Democrats that I know believe that their party wants to or tries to be racist, and both parties are implicated and guilty in the long history of white supremacy in this country. So there is no need for anxiety about partisan politics to distract us from what I think can be a heartfelt, spiritual exploration of how all of our lives are poisoned by racism. We all have a desire to know each other more deeply through the content of our characters. But to do that, we also have to engage with each other as people who are the products of a culture. And that means having a commitment to being race conscious. None of us were immaculately conceived and delivered by the stork. We come from a lineage. And we arrived in the middle of an evolving culture and an amazing human drama to which we are inevitably connected. So we do need to talk about how the cultures that we have come from have shaped the content of our character and have encouraged or diminished the potential of that character to evolve. And here is where I must apologize to people in the room today who identify as people of color, because today I am mostly going to be talking to the white people who are here, one white person to another. Now, I don't know about you all, but it's pretty obvious to me that I grew up in a white supremacist culture. For me, it was an absolutely delightful, loving, family-involved, ethnically proud, Icelandic, Canadian, liberal, Unitarian, Universalist culture. But it was still a white supremacist culture because everybody around me, my family, my teachers, my church, presumed that values, norms, knowledge, governing structures, religion, music, and art created by and for people from European backgrounds was inherently better than those of other cultures. Now, I experienced that in my family's attitude towards rock and roll, which, you know, primarily came out of African-American culture in this country. So a small example of where a small experience from my growing up reflected white supremacy. Now you have to drill down deep below the surface of polite conversation and school curricula and religious practices to get to that underlying belief. But it was there, and why wouldn't it be? Because from the 16th to the 20th century, mid-20th century, European cultures have dominated the world through colonial expansion, not only in North America, but in Africa, in the Middle East, in Polynesia, in Australia, New Zealand, and the Arctic. The cultural values of the European colonizers shaped the ongoing culture of this country. They shaped how we thought about ourselves and about the mission of our country. They shaped how we created our institutions of governance and business. They shaped how we distributed the land and how we created our economic system. So you can describe American culture from a lot of different angles and points of view. Not just this one. But over the past 10 years, in both academic scholarship and in public media, we have seen a broader, I would say, taken now for granted acceptance that it is fair, it is appropriate, it is accurate to describe our culture as a whole, as rooted in white supremacy attitudes, because that is what Europeans have believed and embedded in the countries they colonized. And in the beginning, those white supremacy beliefs of European colonizers took religiously inspired forms that, you know, we really learned all about in our basic history classes. They believed that their Christian religion and Bible represented the only true religion on earth, and that their rulers, their kings, were appointed by God, that people of color were lesser human beings, and that their colonizing efforts, including the exploitation of the resources and the people that they found in the countries they colonized, were also part of a divine plan and for the greater good. They believed that their languages, many European countries had empires, their ideas, their view of the world, and their cultural norms were superior to anyone else's, and that institutions, laws, media, and values they created should take this for granted and preserve that superiority. This is what white supremacy means. Now, insofar today as its most blatant and public form is still being represented in fringe alt-right groups that get a lot of media attention, we white people have an escape hatch that enables us to avoid dealing with the deepest and most important implications of white supremacy, because we can make white supremacy into something that is other. We can project it as a belief that is held by a person who's got a white hood or a Nazi helmet, instead of considering the possibility that we could own it ourselves as a personal spiritual challenge that we must address beyond guilt and shame, but instead as a fact of our lives that makes a difference in our lives, that diminishes our lives. For almost all of my adult life in this church, in Unitarian Universalism, I have been so grateful that this church has offered me both a safe and a challenging place to examine my attitudes about and my role in racism and white supremacy as part of my own personal journey towards wholeness. Now that phrase and title, very appropriate one, is what Unitarian Universalism gave to a broad range of training and curriculum and program opportunities that have been offered in our congregations over the past couple of decades to help us break through a crust of complacency that afflicted our churches about how enlightened and non-racist we liberal Unitarian Universalists obviously are. Now, there may be a dozen or so members of this church who have actively participated in these opportunities over the years and will testify to the fact that it's made a difference in their lives. That, like me, it's been an experience of waking up from sleepwalking whiteness. Slowly, painfully, we are absorbing in our church the realization that being white has only the tiniest amount to do with the color of your skin, and that, in fact, whiteness is an invention. I didn't personally invent it, but it still means that I have privileges within an invented system of intentional social controls. So what does all of this have to do with us today, this church, and this time in our lives? Well, we get to be alive together in this time of struggle that where we are reinventing this country and the institutions that have shaped it, anticipating a rapidly coming age when white supremacy no longer dominates this world. I was grateful when the members of this congregation who had been involved in Journey Towards Wholeness trainings in past years approached me this fall to see whether and how we could together renew and refresh this spiritual exploration. The group's consensus was that we could use a community building tool that's very familiar here at UUCS, the Covenant Group. Covenant groups, of course, are personal, not political. They are about mutual and self-education around a theme rather than about sitting in a training or a course from an expert. They are about listening to each other instead of talking at each other. Covenant groups are also based in promises or covenants that we will support each other in the group by being regular in our attendance, by being respectful of different experiences and opinions, and being disciplined about a style of group discussion that lets everybody, extroverts and introverts alike, have their time to talk and their time to listen. So today I want to invite you to consider being a committed participant in a monthly Journey Towards Wholeness covenant group that we are starting up that's going to meet 6 times only for the rest of this church year, from January through June. It's a small thing that we can offer you to do if this sermon touches you in any way. And we have 2 times that we can announce today where we already have committed facilitators for the groups and committed participants who already know they're going to be there. The first of those times are the 4th Sunday of every month, starting on January 28th, 2 weeks from today, after the church service, for 2 hours from around 11:15 to 1:15. And the second opportunity is the next night, the 4th Monday night, from 7 to 9 here in this building, January 29th. So the sign-up sheets are in the foyer. You can sign up to be in one of those groups. And if those times don't work for you, you can sign up on a sheet that I'm going to have here in the sanctuary for some further discussion and conversation about the sermon and about these opportunities. If you want to, you can hear more about the specific themes we're going to take up in those 6 sessions. So we can find a time to try to find a time to make this possible for you to come if you want to, if those 2 times don't work. There is another intriguing opportunity happening over the next 2 years in our larger denomination for a different kind of group process around our identity as an anti-racist and anti-oppressive and multicultural community. And it is called the 8th Principle Initiative. You probably remember that Unitarian Universalism does not have a common creedal statement that covers the usual theological beliefs that most churches unite around. What we have instead is a statement of 7 principles that form a values framework and vessel for our inclusive faith positions. And the 7 principles were adopted after a multi-year study by delegates representing all of our congregations at a General Assembly back in 1985, and they haven't been amended or expanded ever since. So one of the leaders of the Journey Towards Wholeness movement in Unitarian Universalism is a lay leader from All Souls Church here in Washington, D.C., that some of you know, Paula Cole Jones, who she's been a leading proponent of the idea that we should adopt an 8th principle. And this is how it reads. We covenant to affirm and promote journeying towards spiritual wholeness by working to build a diverse, multicultural, beloved community by our actions that accountably dismantle racism and other oppressions in ourselves and in our institutions. Paula and her collaborators have successfully encouraged the UUA to establish a study commission to review this language and begin a multi-year process of considering this amendment to expand our principles. So I think it's an important conversation for our congregations to be involved in, and we have the blessing of having Paula as a friend of this congregation, a former, I think, workshop leader and presenter here to help us study it. So I've invited her, and she's accepted an invitation to be our pulpit guest here on March 18th to discuss the eighth principle proposal and to help us understand whether and how we can have our own process of considering endorsing it or whether it would be valuable to adopt. Some congregations have actually adopted it already, owning their own right as UU congregations to affirm the UU principles plus one. Others have endorsed it and are working with the institutional implications of what difference it makes as they look at their governance, their nominating processes, their adult education classes, their religious exploration program. So it's an initiative that offers a place for a congregational conversation to begin, and I'm looking forward to the ways that our staff and our board and our leaders can look at this and see if it prompts anything to come alive within us. You know, I hope that this is a conversation that all of our members find compelling, but I do want to acknowledge something about small group opportunities like I'm proposing today to engage in deep reflection about how racism touches our lives. I want to acknowledge that people of color have a different challenge to deal with in a congregation like this one than white people. You know, if you were interested in being in one of these covenant groups and you're a person of color, you might well be the only person of color in the group. And sometimes it's hard for white people to be sensitive to the fact that people of color come from all kinds of different backgrounds and countries and have different experiences when it comes to their racial and ethnic heritage and how racism has affected their lives. And even this term that I'm using so cavalierly, people of color, can be controversial because not all people with skin tone that doesn't look conventionally European looking identify with that term. It's easy in a small group for the majority white participants to expect that the person who doesn't look white to be a strong voice or somehow a leader or their teacher or their father or mother confessor. So some people of color will stay away from groups like this because they don't want to deal with the well-intentioned projections about who they are and what they are presumed to believe. Fair enough. And if that's where you are, believe me, you deserve a break. In congregations like ours, to tell you the truth, I think it is much more important for white people to be talking to each other about how we experience our whiteness. Not that there is not value and power in small groups that are intentionally diversified in having these conversations, but we may not have the numbers to make that possible here. Robin DiAngelo, who's one of the dynamic leaders of this new anti-racist white allies movement, has written about the challenges that white people face in talking among themselves about racism. She says, socialized into a deep internalized sense of superiority and entitlement that we are either not consciously aware of or have a hard time admitting to ourselves, we can become highly fragile in conversations about race. We experience a challenge to our racial worldview as a challenge to our identities as good and moral people. It also challenges our sense of, you know, where is our place in the hierarchy. Thus, we perceive any attempt to connect us to the system of racism as an unsettling and unfair moral offense. Getting it when it comes to race and racism challenges our identities as good white people. But then she goes on to say something that I want to conclude with. But I can testify, she says, that it is also the most exciting, powerful, intellectually stimulating, and emotionally fulfilling journey that I have ever undertaken. It has impacted every aspect of my life, personal and professional. I have a much deeper and more complex understanding of how our society works. I can challenge racism in my daily life more readily, and I have developed cherished and fulfilling cross-racial friendships that I did not have the capacity to engage in before. And you know, that has been true for me too. It's been truly a journey towards wholeness, and one that I hope that we can continue together in the year ahead. So there is a time in the context of this service, the vessel of this service, to have discussion or response right now. But I want to remind you, I'm looking forward to gathering with any of you who would like to talk more about the sermon or the covenant group's idea, or learn more about them after we get some refreshments after the service. So come back into the sanctuary, and we'll meet over maybe near the choir seats, maybe 10 minutes or so after the service ends.